Welcome to the Primal Endurance Podcast. Slow down and enjoy the show, where we rap, literally, about everything you need to know. I'm your host, Brad Kearns. Are you ready? Let's go. Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Primal Endurance Podcast. I'm your host, Brad Kearns, and today we have an assortment of interesting questions from listeners to tackle and gain insights to improve our competency, and our health while we pursue ambitious endurance goals. Which intro do you prefer? Goofy off-key rapping or today's effort? Send your vote to info@primalendurance.fit and we will proceed accordingly. Okay, listeners! You know what? These questions today are really, really interesting and diverse and going really deep. So I'm going to read some long stories at times because we're really getting into some fun stuff. Some of the questions were so challenging that I had to kind of take a pause before I replied, consult other experts like Dr. Lindsay Taylor, Dr. Kate Shanahan, my go-to people, Mark Sisson. And boy, there's not some easy answers sometimes. It's just more reflection. So I'm going to put this stuff out there, and we're all going to have fun together. The first question comes on maximum sustained power training, the evolved concept that we covered extensively in the book Primal Endurance. The proponent is Jock DeVore, a prominent trainer in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, and also a competitive master's cyclist in his own right. And I tried to explain it. I was recording the show, and I bundled it up so bad that I actually stopped and started over. So I know it deep down. I got fully immersed into Jock's scene with a lengthy meeting over there at his beautiful gym in West Los Angeles called Sirens and Titans. Go check it out. They have a VersaClimber room. Can you believe that? Like a group VersaClimber class. If you don't know what VersaClimber is, Mark Sisson's feelings will be very hurt. That's his favorite gym equipment, piece of equipment of all time. Do a quick hit on Google and you can see what this beautiful machine is. It's like a vertical climbing machine. And Mark once set the world record in the VersaClimber for the fastest climb of a vertical mile. So he climbed 5,280 feet in the air. If you can imagine a ladder that size. And I think his time was 22 minutes and change. So he was basically going all out on this crazy machine that works your arms and your legs. Wonderful, low impact, and nice that Jock brought it back into prominence. But anyway, I got fully immersed into the concept, very carefully wrote about it in the book, and now trying to explain it, I bungled it up. So I'm going to tap into the hard work that was already done and do some excerpting from the book. Okay, how's that? So maximum sustained power involves lifting heavy weights in the gym during carefully structured workouts designed to improve your maximum power and your ability to sustain the highest possible percentage of your absolute maximum power for as long as possible. And this is relative to your competitive event. So the nature of your maximum sustained power workout should sync with the average power output and duration of your goal event. This is what DeVore calls the workout's correlation coefficient. For example, a shot putter doing a maximum sustained power workout is going to have some very, very heavy weights, fewer reps, and more rest in between his maximum sustained power sets than an endurance athlete who's going to be using a lighter weight and overall doing more reps as they're trying to correlate with, let's say, staying strong in the latter stages of a marathon or an Ironman triathlon or an ultra run. So let's take the example of deadlifting, very simple, and an endurance athlete's going to go in there. And again, this workout is to train the other sides of the equation from that extreme endurance accumulation of hours and miles. So it's going to be a short duration workout. It's going to be explosive. It's just different than explosive means something different to the endurance athlete than it does to the shot putter. So I'm making that point. So let's say the endurance athlete sets that deadlift bar at the massive weight of 180 pounds. That's about around the weight that I use. And in the gym circles, that's pretty wimpy. I think Brian, who's mastering the recording, is doing at least double that. So 360, 180, whatever, no big, you know, no big concern, minor detail. But let's say the endurance athlete is going to, you know, dabble in this stuff, not risk injury by loading up a heavy weight and just working with 180. And so what you're going to do are these mini sets where you're maintaining that perfect form, that explosiveness, and you're not pushing yourself to absolute failure in any single set. So you're going to be doing a comfortable, let's say the first time you lift up the bar, you're going to be doing a comfortable 5 reps. Then you're going to put it down, rest, recover, catch your breath, come back. Maybe the next set is going to be 4 nice clean reps, allowing for a little bit of attrition, fatigue. And then you're going to come back and do 3 reps, rest, come back and do 3 more reps, rest, come back and do 2, another set of 2, another set of 2, and finally a set of 1, right? Because you are getting tired. But still, if you only have to do 1 rep on your last set, 1 to 2 reps the last few sets, they're still going to be explosive with good form. You have enough rest. And then you're going to have a nice little package where, count it up, if you did 5, 3, 2, 2, 2, 1, something like that, you're doing, let's say, 14 reps of 180 pounds. That's 2,500 pounds total. And in contrast, if you did your typical strength training session where you go to failure, so you're hitting that 180-pound bar the first time, and you can do, let's say you can do 8 reps before you drop it, and you've fatigued yourself pretty well, you get some rest, you come back, and maybe on your second set, you can do 5, and then you're done, and you're more fatigued, maybe some breakdown of the muscles, all that stuff happened because you went all the way to failure. You're going to be lifting less total weight if you add up only doing 8 and 5, that's only 13 reps, where in this series of mini sets, you did 16 or 17 reps. So that's the basic concept of maximum sustained power. I would give myself a B minus or C plus explaining it right there. So go read about it in the book in detail, or even look for Jock's book. He's got a whole book out about it. And so back to Charles's question about how often do you do it? Do you want to have the ultimate goal where you're doing MSP each week with a certain frequency? So the answer is no. It's a very clear point in the book that we want to do our explosive anaerobic power strength training sessions during only these narrow windows of intensity that we sprinkle into the schedule throughout the year. So as an endurance athlete, your main goal is to improve your ability to burn fat and sustain a steady pace for a long time. So the vast majority of your workouts are going to be aerobic in nature under that magic number of your maximum aerobic heart rate. But when it's time to go hard and go intense, you're going to throw down some really impressive workouts. You can consider it icing on the cake for your endurance-based training. And those will come in, let's say, 3 to 4 week blocks, ideally, and then intersperse with rest week, returning to mini periods of aerobic base building exclusively, and going in this periodization cycle throughout the competitive season. So the MSP workouts have their time and place, and those will be in distinct anaerobic training phases. So that's my answer to wanting to do it every single week or doing a few workouts a week. Not necessary. Again, a little goes a long way. That's the main concept to take away from where intensity and strength training fits into the endurance athlete schedule. Then there's a question about sets and reps, and I think I explained that with the hypothetical example of doing the deadlift and coming back, making sure you get sufficient rest, and then doing quality sets. And you're working with a pretty heavy weight. Let's say that you're, if you're choosing 180 pounds, and you could do that all out maximum effort until failure only 8 times, then you're doing these sets where you're doing 6, 4, 4, 3, 3, 2, 2. It's a pretty impressive workout, especially in context of endurance being your main goals. But definitely doing that, being okay doing those descending sets where you're minimizing the reps and minimizing the exhaustion factor that a lot of people get into when they're going and pushing themselves hard. These are short duration workouts where you're in and out of the gym and the whole thing's over in 20 minutes, 30 minutes. The key point there being that you don't want to stimulate this fight or flight response and have these hormones floating around in your bloodstream for an hour and 27 minutes. And unfortunately, that's a lot of what happens when you go hire the personal trainer and you're working through all the stations and resting and coming back and doing more and feeling exhausted, but getting a little rest and coming back and doing more. You're bathed in stress hormones. You feel good. You feel like you really worked hard. The endorphins are flowing as you're driving back home with your hand a little bit shaking on the steering wheel because you really work those muscle fibers. But generally speaking, that's a workout that's going to entail a lot of recovery time. There's a lot of breakdown, and that overstimulation of stress hormones is going to compromise your overall training progress because the penalty is so high. So instead, go hard, get out of there, and go home. And that's when you're really tapping into what it's all about to train in an explosive manner as for that power and strength. And when you do it right, when you do it few and far between and have these workouts go a long way, that's when you can really gain the most benefits as an endurance athlete, where you feel stronger and maintain your form in the latter stages, the latter hours of those events, when all the other endurance athletes are just falling apart because they never train that maximum, you know, that peak output. So very, very effective and powerful workouts, especially the way Jacques designed it with maximum sustained power. There's a nice account in the book where he was working with the great American cyclist Dave Zabriskie, many times national champion, many times Tour de France competitor, had the yellow jersey for a while, 1 year in the Tour, one of the best time trialists out there. And he was getting deep into this MSP stuff, doing some impressive work in the gym, and putting up training times that were surpassing even when he was in peak form and doping his ass off, as he admitted, and all the U.S. cyclists of that era admitted. So he was trying to make a comeback as a clean athlete and losing that tremendous advantage that EPO and the other drugs provide. But with this sensible training pattern and building his explosiveness in the gym, he was going up these timed mountain climbs like the famous Latigo in Los Angeles at record speeds. And then unfortunately, early in his season, he crashed in the Tour of California. And it was at that stage of his career where he said, okay, I'm going to pack it in, which is always a great idea. You know, when you're at the end of your rope there and a misfortune happens, there's other things in life to pursue. Speaking of that, I just saw this trailer for this very interesting documentary. I think it was called The Halo. It was about the British triathlete Tim Don. Had a horrible accident a couple days before the Hawaii Ironman while training in the area of Kailua Kona. And he opted for this really painful several month journey where he had to wear the halo at all times and get the screws drilled into his skull and a lot of rehab and pain and suffering. But he had that driving goal to get back out on the race course. I mean, this guy was a favorite to win the Ironman. He had broken the world record at Ironman earlier that same year. I think it was 2017. Yeah. He dropped a 7 hour and 40 minute Ironman performance in Brazil. Obviously, it doesn't make sense to compare performances on different race courses, but the guy was in top shape. And then it all taken away from him with a encounter with a truck in Kailua Kona. And speaking of that, if you're one of those folks listening that likes to go out to Kona and race or aspires to, be careful out there on the island, because I've heard about so many terrible accidents over the years. Pat Griscus, who was an old-time triathlete competing with prosthetic limb, and he did all these great achievements and was a prominent endurance athlete, and he had his life taken on an accident out there in the Kona area just training. So yeah, and speaking of that, in general, one other plug, I've done it on the show before, but if you're out there riding your bike, remember that of all the dangerous things you do in your life, road cycling is probably the number one by a factor of 10 or 20 times more dangerous than the second thing on your list. What is the second thing on your list? Do you do stupid shit with a chainsaw and try to trim trees in the winter? Or do you climb on a ladder in the pouring rain and try to clean out your rain gutters? That stuff's really stupid and dangerous. But you know, there's nothing comparing to road cycling for most of us. And to me, I'm just going to say, it's not even worth the risk. The pleasure, the enjoyment of being out there and doing it is not worth the risk. And so if I'm going to ride my road bicycle, I'm going to choose a bike trail where I do not have to encounter any traffic whatsoever. Next best thing, if you insist on riding and training for the events, I would say, get in your vehicle and drive to a safe spot to start and end your rides. It doesn't have to go out of your garage door. I know it's more fun to wheel out through your neighborhood and wave to the passersby and your fans and on your home street. But that's one, is go find safe routes. And if you have to travel 12 minutes in the automobile, so be it. That's number one. Number two is do a lot of your training on the mountain bike, on trails. It makes you strong. It's going to translate really well, especially to the time trial aspects that triathletes are going for, just trying to get that raw power and that wattage. And if you're a road cyclist and you need to have that that pack riding effect, that's oftentimes safer than being out there solo. So, get in the pack of 100 riders. We used to do that in Los Angeles. There was some famous rides like the Tuesday night ride in the San Fernando Valley and the Saturday ride also in the valley, where this massive pack would come and we would take over the roads. And of course the cars knew what was going on. And we had cred out on the roads because of the sheer volume. There was very little danger that someone was going to be inattentive and run into 100 cyclists, if you know what I mean. But when you're out there by yourself, you're fighting a battle against your expeditions and explorers and Yukons and these monstrous vehicles that are operated in many cases by people using a handheld digital device. I know we're not supposed to, but people are inattentive in a way that they never have been in the history of driving. And it's absolutely a recipe for disaster. So much disaster happens in the cycling and triathlon multi-sport communities. So this is my public service announcement to go find safe routes, do a lot of mountain biking, ride in packs if you can. And then also, this is a fun one, wear bright clothes, as bright as you can. Go online right now. I wish I had an affiliate relationship with, neonbikeclothing.com. But if you can get this crazy pink safety gear or yellow safety gear type of coloring, just like the road workers know, that's a very, very important aspect of them keeping safe out there, is to wear their yellow or orange safety vests. Buy the craziest bike clothing as you can. And if your favorite Tour de France team and their kit is dark gray with black shading, get rid of it, man. Throw it away. Give it away. Bring it to Goodwill and get crazy, obnoxious, bright yellow shorts with a big giant pink tongue sticking out. Whatever it is to gather more attention for yourself on the road. I would even go so far as to say, get a helium balloon and tie it to your seat post every time you go out for a bike ride. Or one of those safety flags that they used to give the kids in the old days. Just be obnoxious. I know I heard Lance Armstrong talking on his great podcast, The Forward. Love that stuff. He's doing a great job. He also has the Stages podcast, where they're talking about not just the Tour de France, but many other stage races and endurance events, kind of an offshoot of The Forward podcast. But he was saying that he has a flashing red light mounted on the back of his on his seat, and he uses it all the time. Use it during the day. Hazard lights, man, put them on there. The hazard is that you're a bike and they're cars. So don't feel bad about, calling attention to your vehicle in every way possible. Okay. Is that enough on that? How about that? Yeah. Be safe out there. Thank you. Oh, so my further comments to Charles on maximum sustained power is that, as a matter of fact, I do deadlifting several days a week, because I might just do one set when I get out of the cold tub to rewarm, or I just see the hex bar. I just recently bought this hex bar. It's so fun. It's much safer than a regular bar for me anyway, because I have concerns about straining my back. It's happened a few times, and it's no fun when you're doing deadlifting and you feel that grab in your lower back. I'm just not a competent, powerful strength training athlete. So I'm kind of looking for all ways to make it safer. And this hex bar has been a great find. And so I'll go there and just haul off a couple sets just for fun. I'll do 2x5 reps and then go about my busy day. It doesn't count as a workout. I'm not really thinking of it as an official formal strength training session that I'm going to log in my logbook, but I'm working on my form and I'm working on making that sealed air space in my abdominal cavity per instruction from my deadlift coaches, Brian McAndrew, who's mastering the recording, and also Layla McGowan, who's our wonderful cookbook author that we've brought into the mix recently. She's also a moderator of the Keto Reset group on Facebook and doing some great stuff. Check out her Instagram, is strong.and.wellfed. And then check out Brian's stuff at Whole Dudes. Of course, we all know Whole Dudes. It's the viral Instagram account. One of the best things I've ever seen on Instagram. And that's spelled Whole, WHOLEDOODS. Oh my gosh. The amount of delicious food on there, the motivational and inspirational level of seeing these meals and these clever comments like, I'm eating this. You can't get any better on Instagram. So I like to just hit that deadlift bar frequently. It's sort of not counting as an MSP session. But then during those times of the year when you're into the strength training phase, you could shoot for doing a couple of those a week. I also like to give a plug for the body weight exercises, especially for endurance athletes, just trying to get that competency. I like to do decline Spider-Man push-ups. You can search for that on YouTube, Brad Kern's Decline Spider-Man Push-Ups, the hardest push-up of all time. I want to have the toughest one so I can do fewer reps and get tired. And so I'll try to do I'll try to complete 100 decline Spider-Man push-ups a couple days a week, maybe more at my best, as just sort of a throw in for general fitness competency. And so those will come in sets of like 40 or 45 and then 30 and then 25 and then get to that magic number of 100. And then other days when I'm really doing a formal strength training session and throwing in other things, I'll get to 200 of these decline Spider-Man push-ups. I'll also do stretch cords to complement that workout. And then I'll do sets of deadlifts. And I'll just be wandering around the house. I don't have to go to a gym to do that. And I kind of like that. It's sort of my motivation to conduct an excellent workout at home is like, oh, should I get in the car and go to the gym and do my strength training session? Eh, I'm feeling kind of lazy. It is, after all, a 7-minute drive to the gym. And so I'll just knock stuff out at home. That'll be pretty awesome. Oh, so in talking about that, maintaining the quality of each set, I was writing back to Charles and commenting on my propensity for doing picnic table jumps in the park. When I go to the park visiting my parents, there's this awesome park in Woodland Hills, California called Serenia Park, and they have all these stone picnic benches at convenient intervals. And so I'll hit the bench and do a set of my decline Spider-Man push-ups and always try to finish 100 before I finish the half-mile loop through the park. But then near the end, I'll also do some vertical jumps up onto the top of the picnic table. So if you're going picnicking there, please wipe down the table before you set your food out. But I'll notice that I can get to about 10 vertical jumps. I'll jump up and then jump back down and take that impact too, trying to maintain my bone density as I age. But when I get to about 10, I start to get a little bit sloppy, on the 9th and 10th one. And so that's your cue to stop. You don't want to be doing explosive strength training workouts when you notice your form breaking even a little bit. You don't want to be exhausted after these efforts. They're supposed to be explosive. And if you talk to any sprinter or quality explosive power athlete, this is absolutely a fundamental component of their training approach. They're not dragging themselves to the finish line and, considering it a badge of honor when they're falling apart on the last few reps. That's absolutely ridiculous. They're going for perfect form and maintaining a heightened awareness of that point where they start to crack. Okay, next question is from David Lapp, of now becoming a prominent contributor to the show. Love these email exchanges with this guy. Very forward-thinking, progressive, training-minded, recovery, health, the whole picture. And just an ordinary guy with an important job over there on the East Coast in the attorney governmental world. I'm saying this because my mom, who's doing the timestamps, the transcripts of the show, was trying to Google him when I mentioned his name on other shows. And she's like, I couldn't come up with anything on this guy. So I told David, man, get your social media thing going. Get your A game up there. He's like, no, man, I'm too busy. Plus, I need my 8 to 9 hours of sleep. So why mess around on social media? Good answer. Okay, so David says, I'm trying to get rid of any remaining consistency obsession that I've been guilty of most of my life. Admittedly, it's hard, and I appreciate you harping on the consistency obsession many of us have. Now, how do you reconcile developing habits versus staying away from this excessive consistency where you're getting into the chronic training patterns? You've talked about your practice of doing core work every morning before you get out of bed. Go look at YouTube, Brad Kern's morning routine. To my great surprise and delight, it's up to an absolutely viral 7,000 views. Pretty incredible. So check it out. But yeah, I'm really, really happy with this recent inclusion into my A game of life. I've been doing this, I think, for coming up on about a year now, where I just decided that if I could do something every single day without fail, before I even got out of bed, so I devised this flexibility mobility routine, and it was custom to my desire to perform well and recover more easily from sprinting and high jumping sessions. So I'm working the hip flexors and trying to get that hip mobility and especially that hamstring flexibility with a series of raises and kickouts and leg swings. And it's all good core work because I'm stabilizing while I'm flying my legs around like Circus Boy in bed. And it's a really fun start to my day. And it's very doable. I actually do, I have to admit, a little bit less than I showed on the video because I just took down the time duration of the morning routine so that I would absolutely never miss it, which was my most prominent goal. So I think the only time I miss it is like if I'm getting up early and trying to catch a flight, and sometimes I just won't do it and I'll go do it in the airport instead, getting very nice eyebrow raises from all the passersby where I'm swinging my legs wildly from side to side, making sure I'm not hitting anybody in the airport. But anyway, every single morning I'm doing this morning routine. And so that's, you know, a plug in the area of consistency. And this brilliant question that David's getting at is, where do you draw that line between being fluctuating and intuitive and not overtraining, and then also getting into good habits? So I appreciate it very much and thought about it a lot. David continues and says, the book Brave Athlete, Calm the F Down also talks about habit building. That's from Simon Marshall. Look forward to talking to that guy. He's a good friend of Chris Kelly and Dr. Tommy Wood in the Nourish Balance Thrive organization. He's been brought in there officially recently and has some great insights. Anyway, so David says, I've gotten in the habit of doing different planks consistently every morning. Is that consistency bad or is this a good habit? If I'm hearing you right, perhaps it's just the intensity of what you're doing. For example, eliminate the obsession over consistently working out every day, or perhaps consistently getting in a long run every week if your intuition's telling you you need a break. But consistency in the form of a little healthy habit forming small measures are good if they don't add much stress. Oh, yes. Very well said. I think you answered your own question where we want to have these winning habits. We want to begin our days in a proactive manner so that we can maintain that mindset and maintain that sort of disposition when we're forced into reactive mode by all the things that happen to us every day, especially when we click into our email inbox. And then it's all about reacting and getting pulled away from your peak performance priorities that you might have written down on a little notepad, and now the notepad's buried under an avalanche of email. And so for us that want to promote fitness and pursue ambitious athletic competitive goals, getting those patterns in place where it's automatic, you don't even have to think about it, is a wonderful attribute. I'm also going to put into this category my daily cold plunge. So I do my morning routine in bed, and then I immediately proceed to the chest freezer for a few minutes of cold therapy with the water anywhere between 33 and 40 degrees. We're arguing over that. My fellow users want to have it a little higher. I like to keep it right above freezing and spend consequently lesser time duration in there. But that is a fixture in my morning routine. I do not have to use any psychic energy to motivate myself to get into the chilly, chilly water. It's just routine, kind of like brushing your teeth or washing your hands or turning on the shower and getting in the shower. So I feel like that contributes to my ability to focus, to be resilient in the face of challenge, just because I've made it an automatic behavior. So I'm going to give a huge plug for those beneficial automatic behaviors, like designing a morning flexibility mobility routine. Now, compare and contrast with my vicious counter argument against consistency in the context of endurance training. And what I mean by that and that commentary that I've made on other shows is that we fall into this pattern where we set these arbitrary goals like, I want to get my mileage up to 40 miles a week and consistently be there as I prepare for this year's marathon. Or as a triathlete, the triathletes like to say, yeah, I want to get my 10 workouts in a week, every single week, and really be consistent about this year so I can improve my race performances from last year, which when I was a little more flaky. And a lot of times these notions are doing more harm than good because you're forcing your body to do things that it's not naturally meant to do in the name of this this mental goal of writing down a consistent pattern of workouts, thinking that equates with fitness progress. And really what it often comes down to is a consistent application of a little too much stress to the body with insufficient rest and downtime. And so replacing that goal of consistency, I would say that you want to have the main goal is to constantly balance stress and rest effectively in your training patterns. And what that might mean at times, I know it did for me during my 9-year career racing as a pro and pushing myself really, really hard and traveling a lot. A lot of times what that meant to balance stress and rest was that I had to be wildly inconsistent with my training patterns. In other words, I would have to spontaneously take a couple weeks off and do almost no training in late July if I was feeling fried from an aggressive spring race schedule that started in April with a lot of travel, a lot of difficult racing down in the Caribbean in the tropical climate where we're blasting our brains out in the intense heat of St. Croix and running as fast as we can for a half Ironman race course with incredible mountain climbs and something that'll, you know, cause a massive amount of stress to the body, hormonal, physical, psychological, and require a lot of recovery time. But you don't notice it right away because you're bathed in stress hormones as you're competing and traveling and getting back on the bike the next day and trying to train for the next race. And so you can ride on this high for a while. And then what you really require is a significant period of downtime to balance out those high periods where you were going hard. So there wasn't a lot of consistency on the upside. I was racing and training much harder than I might during a, you know, traditional training pattern where I'm based at home and going out there and trying to build a base and throw in some speed workout. Once you get on the plane and start traveling around and doing crazy things to your body in the boiling hot temperatures, this is nothing consistent. It's you know, extreme. And then to balance that, you need extreme rest. So whether or not you're flying around on the world circuit, even if you've been pushing yourself for several months of, you know, good application of training stress, best results often come when you just take a step back and reject the notion of consistency and realize that during those down periods where you cut your weekly mileage in half for 3 straight weeks or crazy, horrific thoughts like that, that's when you can get the most improvement. Try it, read the success stories, talk to the world's greatest elite endurance athletes that so many of them I interview in the Primal Endurance Mastery course. And if you haven't signed up for the course yet, boy, I would really consider doing that immediately as we're approaching the competitive season and just picking and choosing the wonderful video interviews from the experts just for the entertainment and the education value, and then also going through the course in a methodical manner as I take you step by step through the concepts in every single chapter in the book Primal Endurance. So when you log onto this portal and you get a PDF of the print book, you get an audio book, you get all kinds of supportive audio content, and also some written content, other cookbooks and things like that are all thrown into this portal that you have access to for life. And then when you navigate through the videos, what you see is first an organization by chapter, so you can proceed through the book in a linear manner. And then you also see navigation by the last name of the expert guest. So you can jump right to the Kelly Starrett stuff if you're interested in flexibility and mobility and how important that is for your overall performance and preserving good technique, even as you fatigue, which is a huge component of success in endurance sports and often one that's overlooked and disrespected by the vast majority of endurance athletes. Okay, so that was my mid-roll plug for the course. But you know what? To make it fun and exciting, since you're listening, I'm going to give you 20% off. I have a special top secret code that actually works on primalblueprint.com. And you can look at the navigation bar that says courses and find that Primal Endurance Mastery course. You can also go from primalendurance.fit and hit the register now button. And this code, BRAD20, BRAD20, will give you 20% off your enrollment fee. That's a huge savings. Don't tell anybody. Okay, tell anybody you want, any of your training partners. But put this code in. It works for now. I don't know how long it's going to. People can't believe I'm giving that much of a discount, but we're doing it because I really appreciate you guys listening to the show and contributing with your feedback, comments, or just your ears. Hopefully it's helping. Anyway, so reject the notion of consistency when it comes to trying to reach arbitrary training standards, and also the idea that your overall training volume and work output is going to be the same every single week. That's a recipe for disaster. And then in another category, we're going to have these positive daily habits where you're doing the morning routine, where you're doing foam rolling in the evening to kind of unwind and stimulate the parasympathetic response and get yourself ready for transition into a good night's sleep. Does that make sense? David answered it beautifully, and I hope I added a lot to make that critical distinction. Okay, Todd has a curious question about the fight or flight response. If someone takes a very long walk or a hike even, 3 to 4 hours, at a brisk pace but maintaining a heart rate well below maximum aerobic heart rate, is it possible to still trigger the fight or flight response in the body? So the answer is moderately, yeah, because you're out and about for 4 hours. You're probably going to get tired in the latter stages, even if you're a really fit athlete. A four-hour hike is nothing trivial in comparison to our typical hectic modern life experience where we're spending long periods of time in stillness, not exercising, just sitting around, unless you're, you know, doing a heavy manual labor job. Maybe a 3 to 4 hour hike is less physical output than your usual day. But most of us in the endurance scene and listening to the show are balancing largely sedentary lifestyle patterns, career patterns, commuting, consuming digital entertainment in the evening. We're balancing those attributes with our devoted attention to endurance training. So what's wrong with stimulating the fight or flight response a little in a moderate manner for a 4 hour hike? That's how the body works. The stress hormones go into the bloodstream and allow you to function and give you a little bit of an inflammatory response so that your legs will pump throughout the duration of the hike. So the moderate stimulation of stress hormones is just fine. The extreme stimulation of the fight or flight response is a wonderful element of overall total healthy living once in a while for short duration, okay? So let's say I'm jumping into the cold plunge chest freezer. I am causing a immediate spike in stress hormones. The fight or flight response is activated immediately because my plunging into the cold water is perceived as a life or death threat. So I experience increased oxygen delivery throughout the cells in my body, increased blood circulation. I have a boost of epinephrine and norepinephrine into my brain. So I have an immediate boost in cognitive function and a sense of well-being and calmness and all those great attributes that were detailed wonderfully in the Mark's Daily Apple post titled The Not-So-Definitive Guide to Cold Therapy. So go read that and realize how come I'm such a big fan and proponent right now. But that's different because I'm getting out in 3 minutes or 5 minutes, or if you're a big timer like Dude Spellings and you're going into the 50-degree pond for 20 minutes because he's habituated to that, and that gives him a nice hormetic stressor, not too much, but we get out before it becomes an overstress or a breakdown effect of stimulating the fight or flight response for too long. Same with our general training pattern, where we're honoring maximum aerobic heart rate rather than kicking into a little bit of overproduction of stress hormones several days out of the week or, you know, routinely during our training pattern because we fail to respect the importance of limiting heart rate to that aerobic maximum. So when you're training below MAF heart rate, you're minimizing the fight or flight output. You're minimizing the stress hormone burst into the bloodstream, and therefore your body's well adapted to do something like that frequently. So when we stimulate fight or flight, we want it to be brief and get back into homeostasis afterward. That's what it's designed. That's what our genetics are allowing for. It's to keep us alive when we're running from the saber-toothed tiger, as everyone always uses that example. Unfortunately, what's happening today is when we have toxic relationship dynamics in the workplace or in the home, in the family, we have this kind of over-amped, over-competitive, type AAA mindset where we're commuting and stressed about the traffic and also carrying on a phone call and having it be a contentious phone call about the deal that's about to fall apart. And so we're bathed in these fight or flight hormones from the time we start our commute throughout the day at workplace and then when we get home, continuing in these negative and toxic communication and living patterns. Included in that mix could be doing an overly stressful workout to blow off steam after your busy, stressful, hectic day at the office. Again, fight or flight all day long at work, and then more fight or flight with what you think is a something that's in the name of your health when you go do the track workout or the intense spinning class or get on the, what's it called, the Peloton bike at home and pound away with your New York City fancy instructor. These are all things that stimulate the stress response, and they need to be respected and balanced with things like yoga, meditation, taking a quiet stroll in the neighborhood with a little dog and looking at the stars, or just sitting in quiet reflection or chatting, visiting, playing a game of chess, reading a nice book in a quiet setting. All those kind of things that are calming and relaxing, drinking your chamomile tea and doing a little stretching on the carpet and foam rolling, all that kind of fun stuff, which we kind of neglect if we're in that type AAA, highly motivated, goal-oriented, driven personality category. Okay, so that's my answer about the hiking. Good stuff. Have fun and balance it with downtime. Okay, here's Travis. And this is kind of a success story. Interesting stuff. A little lengthy, but I think emphatic vote in favor of training according to the primal endurance approach, the MAF heart rates, emphasizing aerobic development. So Travis says, I took on the transition of going low-carb keto along with the majority of my training in MAF, and I had great results. I'm 39. I've been running ultras for 13 years. Wow. I'm not elite, but I perform at a pretty high level. I've run 50 ultra marathons, including 10 100-mile races, including Leadville 100 in under 24 hour. I did a 19 hours, 45 minutes at the Mountain Lakes 100 in Oregon. I'm proud of my achievements, but I want to illustrate that the way I was training and eating before was just fine, and I was performing at a high level. However, as I close in on my fourth decade, I decided it was time to take a bigger picture look at health and what implications it could have on me in the long term. I love doing this stuff I'd want to do it as long as possible. But long story short, I decided to drop my carb intake back to 50 grams a day, going for that ketosis magic number for about 4 weeks, and also lower my running pace to under MAF during this time. I know, like everyone else, it was hard to swallow my pride and walk up a hill during a road run in the early parts of this transition over to MAF emphasis training. I stuck with it. I kept telling myself it was part of the process, and the reason I have to walk is because my aerobic base is junk and I need to work on it. Okay, so he was committed to the program. Dr. Lindsay Taylor, in our interviews on the Primal Endurance Mastery course, talks about that need to completely buy in and fully commit to your goal. So you have to believe in it, because if you pursue a goal without full commitment and full belief, you're going to have a really wavering commitment level, and you're going to have a high propensity to bomb out and say, forget it. So that was a really nice attitude that he mentioned there, that when he did have to walk and we felt that sense of frustration. If you're a sub 20 hour, 100 mile runner guy that's done 10 hundreds and 50 ultras and the watch beeps and you're walking up a hill, I don't think that's going to be a really comforting feeling. That's going to be terribly frustrating knowing, you know, what kind of performance level you've achieved. But he's going for bigger and better, and also preserving his health as he gets into his fourth decade, starting to think about that stuff, man. Okay. Now, after he got his base going, his initial transition, put some time in, he started adding strides, pickups, fartlek-type workouts once a week or so. Everything else was in the MAF zone. So after he built up some momentum with his initial transition over to MAF-based training, slowing things down, he started adding in some strides, pickups, fartlek-type workouts once a week or so, keeping everything else in the MAF zone and making sure I was really recovered from the times that he opened up the throttle a little. I relaxed and skipped or moved a workout around here and there when I was traveling, and things got crazy with my daughters at home, family priorities. I concentrated on good sleep habits and mobility. The end result, my first test was a 50K race with 5,000 feet of vertical gain. My concern was, did I have enough speed? I hadn't been doing my normal track workouts, hard interval training, or running anything fast since I was in math most of the time. Race day came, I had a great day. I averaged sub 7 minute mile pace for the last 7 miles of the race without ever having strung together 7 minute miles for 7 miles in training. Okay, so at the end of a 50K difficult race, that's a 31 mile race with 5,000 feet of elevation gain, he was able to sustain a faster pace than he had been training at for months. He was running, math pace was above 7 minutes. I was also able to take in fewer calories than normal, only around 150 an hour. I had good constant energy, no gut bombs through the first 5 hours of the race because I wasn't constantly jamming food in like he used to. It was a scary proposition to go out on a limb and do things differently when what I had been doing was mostly working pretty well. I can't speak for everyone, but I can say that I did not lose any speed going for maximum aerobic heart rate training for the majority of my workouts as I built up to this competitive event. As a result, I was less stressed out during training, recovered faster, and didn't have all the issues of fighting colds that normally comes with big training volume. All right, great story. And yeah, look, we're talking about an ultra athlete here. And so the concept of speed, I get this so often in questions and commentary where these triathletes, ultramarathon runners, marathon runners are concerned about the speed element of their training. And we should actually ban that word from anyone in the endurance scene, because there really is nothing that should be called speed when we're talking about training for races that last more than 15 minutes. It's really about strength. It's about maintaining a sensible pace, a respectable pace, even as you fatigue in the latter stages of the race. So let's take the simple example of a marathon, and we have a very competent runner that's trying to break 3 hours. What is that? About 6:30s or 6:45s? I can't remember. Sorry. I know 6 minute pace is a 2:37. So they have 23 more minutes. So yeah, it's just under 7 minute per mile to break 3 hours, the magic 3 hour barrier in the marathon. That's not speed when you're running a 7 minute mile. That's jogging, right? But it's a very, very difficult thing to do for 26 miles. So you see a lot of marathoners going out and doing quarters or repeat half miles where they're working on the speed element of their training. And that can be some nice icing on the cake, but the main benefits and the main contribution to your peak performance is going to come when you are strong enough to continue to click off 7 minute miles, even as you fatigue from hour two to hour three or hour three to hour four in training. So we want to make sure we have a complete understanding of what speed is. Speed is tapping into the anaerobic metabolism, right? I mean, literal definition of speed. And we don't do that when we're competing in races that last for an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours, 16 hours. In fact, the shocking stats, I believe these are in the Primal Endurance book, of the relative contribution of the aerobic and anaerobic system to energy output at different duration of performances. The cutoff point for 50-50, and so a 50% contribution of aerobic and 50% contribution of anaerobic, is a race that lasts 1 minute and 15 seconds. Trip out on that. So even the mile, I mean, you know, these guys are going fast. They're running, you know, sub 4 minute mile. Hickam El Guerrouj running a 3:43 mile. It seems like a full sprint for any mortal person, and he's doing that for the whole way. He's still going more percentage of aerobic contribution than anaerobic. And that's why the milers are typically training high volume endurance training. They're running 100 miles a week to go break the world record in the mile. And when we get up to 5K or an hour time trial, whatever event you're doing, that's a 98% aerobic event and only 2% anaerobic, even when you're going all out for an hour. So that should reframe the notions that we're contributing, the anaerobic system is contributing in large measure to endurance performance. Even a 5K, can you believe that? So for an ultra, the point is not to do speed workout, because when you do these explosive, short duration, high intensity speed workouts, whether it's strides, Farlek, repeats, hill repeats, whatever you're doing, you're teaching your body to perform at maximum output, and that has a direct correlation to improve performance at all intensities lower than that, because you're building musculoskeletal resiliency. You are helping your body preserve good form even as you fatigue by overloading it with sprinting. That has a direct correlation to keeping your form better when you hit mile 20 and you're shuffling along during the marathon. And finally, those mental benefits, and this is described in the book and in some of the videos, where if you become good at sprinting, or you can focus and stay strong for a series of 400 meter repeats, for example, this will correlate directly into your race pace when you're doing a 5K or doing a marathon, feeling a lot easier because your nervous system knows how to fire the muscles and, you know, flex the dorsiflex the foot as it leaves the ground and prepares to generate maximum propulsive force with each stride that you're teaching yourself to do in a dramatic manner when you're running a sprint. Those same attributes come into play when you're jogging along. You just get better at them because you've pushed it to the maximum. Does that make sense? Okay. So great success story from Travis. Thank you so much. That was a great show. Please send in your thoughtful questions and comments and success stories. This is very helpful to read. So info@primalendurance.fit. Thanks for listening. This is your host, Brad Kearns. Until next time, check out primalendurance.fit. Don't forget my secret code, Brad20. Sign up for the Endurance Mastery course. You will love it. So Chris Kelly, Nourish, Balance, Thrive, we're talking about health, and you're telling me a funny story about your picky four-year-old daughter that won't eat unless there's Primal Kitchen condiments on the table.
It's true. My daughter will not eat unless there's f***ing the Primal Kitchen Wilder. it's this cute thing, actually, she does. We have a local state park called Wilder Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
And she calls the ranch dressing Wilder Ranch dressing. We there's no way we're going to correct her on that. It's just too so endearing.
How old is she?
She's four.
Oh my gosh. So she likes like the mayo on a
slab. Oh yeah. She loves those. So we love them as well. We have, we eat them all the time. We eat the mayo, we eat the balsamic, we eat the ranch, the avocado oil we use all the time. And so, you know, that's completely genuine. And I don't mind talking about that because you took the pain in the ass out of condiments. I really appreciate that.
What an authentic spot from Chris Kelly at Nourish, Balance, Thrive. And yes, Primal Kitchen, you can call it Wilder Ranch dressing if you want. And we'll send 5 cents of the proceeds over to that beautiful state park because they're trying to make ends meet in Santa Cruz Mountains. Thank you very much, Chris.
It's my pleasure.